Newsreel cameraman Jim Wright, Reel 2. How much did it cost to gain exclusive coverage of the grouping of the colour?
Well, it wasn't exclusive. The facilities were granted for a sound camera position at the base of the Wellington statue, and we were asked if we would make a donation to soldiers, one of the soldiers' charities, which we very gladly did. They asked us for 50 guineas and we paid it. Of course, that upset the other newsreels to think that we'd paid all this money for newsreel facilities. And I'm afraid, from that moment on, it became that the newsreel war started to escalate. There was a very serious newsreel war went on for between the various five newsreel companies, buying up exclusive rights, the Grand National, the Derby, test matches, or whatever big event was going, some company would try and buy the rights. And of course, that meant that the other companies had got to steal the picture. I think there was a great deal of picture stealing done in those days. In fact, I think most of the cameramen of all the companies and the management learnt the business the hard way, trying to outdo one another in what is loosely known as stealing the pictures from one another. Somebody would buy the rights, the rest of us would do our best to steal the picture. But of course, that isn't done nowadays. The BBC or the ITV people step in and pay vast sums of money and for exclusive rights for various events. But nobody thinks about stealing it, because the law is such that you can get injunctions now. In those days, we were out on the screen before anybody could apply to a judge in chambers for an injunction.
And were so all the companies equally wealthy and able to buy?
No. The three main companies were Paramount, Movietone, and Gaumont British. And they were the three companies that were in the market for buying up exclusive rights. But, of course, only one company could have the exclusive rights. It meant that all the others would get together and, you know, pinch the picture, as what it was loosely called.
The other companies would actually plot together.
Not together. No, but we would
separately try to get coverage.
Separately, not try, but separately get the pictures. There's no question of trying. We got them. It made no difference who got exclusive rights on the Grand National. Another company would step in and pinch it and get them just as equally as well, and get them on the screen almost as fast. There were occasions when, take the Cup final, we pulled one of the biggest stunts in the business, or at least my chief did at the time, a man named Tom Cummins. I was his news editor, and he instructed me to put an advert in the paper to buy up all the spare available seats that were on the market for the Cup final, and because we'd bought the rights for what was a considerable sum of money in those days, but only a very small amount compared to what is paid today to the Football Association. However, we bought the tickets. And then about a week before the game, we put adverts in the paper, in various papers, under different names and addresses, tickets for sale. And we vetted the applications very carefully and found that at least a dozen of them, if not more, I can't remember the exact number now, came from opposition cameramen. So we had foreknowledge of the seats they were going to occupy, long before the game started, so we were able to tip off the stewards in the various, covering the various seat numbers, various aisles, before the game started, to go down, touch the cameraman on the shoulder, and take him and his camera back to the office, and take the camera away from him, locked the cameras in the safe until the end of the game. So we safeguarded our cup final that way. In fact, only one company managed to get one cameraman's pictures. That was Movietone. So you can imagine one man only filming with a hand camera on an important thing like the cup final. He didn't get much of a picture, but he got something. This went on test matches. Same sort of thing happened, test matches. Go on, British would buy the rights for the when the tests were on, and do everything in their power to stop us from filming. Well, we would hire these electric light floats where men are winched up on cantilever arms, overlook the grounds and take a bit of the game and go around the other side of the ground and take a bit more from that side. Or we'd hire flats overlooking the ground, houses, anything like that. We always got the pictures. I remember one case, Goman British, at Nottingham it was, got a very, very large balloon, inflated it and hung it or set it up on the end of a cable right in front of our main camera position. So two of our men, two of Paramount's men, went and got some air guns and kept firing at it until they caused a rent in the envelope. And of course the balloon sank to the ground and we managed to get that particular test match. Similar sort of thing happened at Lord's. We hired flats overlooking Lord's. Another occasion when we were covering the Oval, a Goman British were trying to stop one of our cameramen working from the top roof of a school by flashing a helio light, heliograph. A heliograph into the camera lens. So all we did was change the camera position very quickly. We'd foreseen this and had another position already set up somewhere else. We managed to get the pictures at the Oval. Now, they did the same thing to us. This went on for the Derby. We once held the rights for the Derby. But you can't stop other companies who are determined as we were. They can't stop them from pinching, as we called it, the event, any more than they can stop us. We managed to succeed in the same way as they succeeded. Well, now, quite a lot of this went on and went on over the years. And it did an awful lot to produce a form of esprit de corps amongst the newsreel and the newsreel cameramen to get good pictures and by and large, I know comparisons are odious. I think we did very well. I think the newsreels of the past, the cinema newsreel of the past, really had news, contained nothing but news. We certainly had commentary over them. We had sound over them. But we didn't waste a lot of footage by having newsreaders reading the story. We used every available footage in telling the story with pictures. That was our job, and so we think the newsreel business is, or was, and still is. It should be told with pictures, and not with the word of mouth. First, pictures first, and then the spoken word afterwards, or with it.
Did you find that the authorities were helpful in affording you facilities?
when the idea caught on, of selling these sporting events for sums of money, naturally they were helpful. They were helpful to the company who would pay the biggest amount of money.
But before that?
Oh, before that, there was a bit of a slog. You see, nobody had ever thought of taking pictures with large trucks and lots of equipment and cameras and microphones and cables strung all over the place. And it was a bit of a fight, but it was all to the good because it taught us our business. We learnt. We really learnt the hard way. In fact, we formed the background to what is done today by Movietone, by BBC and ITV and other people. We were the forerunners of it all.
But offering the authorities money did change their attitude, not unnaturally.
Well, it changed the attitude up to a point, because when the word got round, everybody was out to sell the story as much as possible, but we were out to get the stories without paying for them. You see, the newspapers, for a long time, didn't know anything at all about what is now loosely called checkbook journalism. They'd go out and get the stories, but not pay these vast sums of money they pay nowadays. Not in my day, they didn't, anyhow. At least not to my knowledge, they didn't. We weren't very popular buying up the exclusive rights to these things. But then it did. The buying the exclusive rights did really nothing for us except give you certain camera positions that you wanted. You got the best camera position, which meant that those people who hadn't got the rights would have to go and find alternative ways of getting the story. And we found alternative ways of getting the story. We found alternative ways that even filming the Grand National. Now you'd think it's very easy to pinch the Grand National. I use the word pinch because that's the way the stories were pinched. But even the Grand National has got to have a certain amount of thought for it. I remember once when, I think it was Pathy had the rights for the Grand National, my chief said to me, he said, well, you go up to Liverpool and make arrangements to steal the Grand National. So it was quite simple, really. I hired a barge, loaded it with bales of hay, and put a cameraman in the middle of it. And that was positioned near the canal turn, brought up to the canal turn at the last minute. Another man was on a rostrum, surrounded by stable manure, in the middle of the field, the middle of the course. And at the last minute, he climbed up through the centre of all this, through a trap door, and with his camera, and was able to get a good panoramic view of the entire race. My particular position that year was filming at Beecher's Brook. Quite simple, just stood there with a hand camera amongst the crowd and filmed it. Another man, I think his name was Fred Bayliss, filmed the start of the race by standing on the roof of somebody's tool shed overlooking from a garden overlooking the course. Another place, we built a stand in another garden on the other side of the course, near the brook, I think they call it, or near the there's a brook that runs across there, and got a very good pan shot of about four jumps. And our chief cameraman was up on the grandstand, togged up like a race car with a big luncheon basket, which contained no lunch, but a very good camera inside it, a little flap on the front, and filmed the race from the top of the grandstand, overlooking the finish. In fact, we got a better finish than Pathy did, who had the official position to cover the finish, because we were right opposite the winning post. All this sort of thing went on for years and years and years.
If the people without exclusive coverage could get such good coverage...
Well, you could, you just had...
Why didn't the companies bother to pay these large sums of money?
I think I covered that on an earlier remark by saying that when you had the exclusive rights, you had the choice of positions. Therefore, you had the choicest position. You had the pick of the positions. Therefore, your picture was slightly better. And a picture that's obtained under those conditions is always better. A film is always better than one that you've stolen with cameras from hidden positions or from positions that are purely temporary at the time. But all this helped to build an esprit de corps in the industry and made what I thought a very good spirit amongst all the cameramen of all the different companies.
What would make one company decide to pay more for a certain event than any of the other companies were prepared to do?
Again, esprit de corps. One company would feel that they'd like to advertise the fact that they'd got the exclusive rights.
And the other company would let them.
We'll just let them get on with it and just simply say that we put an advert out and say, well, we will also show the Grand National, or we will also show the Derby, or we will also show the Test matches. So it was a question of cocking a snoot at one another, if you understand the expression.
Yes, I do.
But you see, all this sort of warfare was quite friendly, serious but friendly. But it helped to mould all the people who made up the newsreel industry in the early days. It gave everybody a feeling of belonging to their company. You know, the esprit de corps was very, very high. Everybody's company was the best company. You know, it didn't matter who you spoke to. Our company is better than your company, business.
Even a company like Universal, which had such a...
Look, the man who just died at Universal, Leslie Murray. I think he had loads of guts. He was terrific. He got blown up on an army exercise. They were blowing up a bridge and he wanted to film it. He got too close. He got blown up in that. And his wife had just given birth to one of his children at a particular time, so that wasn't a happy event. He's the first man to ever jump out of an aeroplane in a parachute and a camera. He died only the other day, two or three days ago. You see, this sort of thing, everybody was first in doing something. First something or other. And I think you could say that everybody in the business, at some time or other, had pioneered some idea of taking news pictures. Whether it was from a submarine or in a diver's suit or whether it was up in the air or what have you. I know another cameraman who died quite recently, a man named Cave Chin. He was the first man to ever lick the problem of vibration in an aeroplane with a camera, because usually an aeroplane is going fast, it has a certain amount of vibration in the airframe, and usually film running through a camera at 90 feet a minute is affected by vibration if it's run through at normal speed. And Kei Chen, I'm tickled to death to think that he thought of it. I should have thought of it. I was a flying man myself. I'd be an ex-flying man. I should have thought of it. But he said, look, it doesn't matter how fast or how slow the camera runs in the air. The faster we run the camera, the less vibration. So he was the first man that ever solved that particular problem of getting a nice steady picture in the air by putting the speed up. It is those little things that I call to mind that all help to make picture making a little easier, or lay the foundation. Even trick work and all that sort of thing all had to be thought of in the early days, early camera days, whether it was in a studio or whether it was out on the road. You had all sorts of various tricks people were using, you know, to get results. So I really feel that the early newsreel boys, all of them, were pioneers in that particular field, laid a very fine groundwork, and I don't think enough has been heard of them.
Did you all use the same cameras?
Oh no, all sorts of cameras are used. Mitchells, Akeleys, Eclairs, Newmans, IMOs, DeVries, you name it, we had them.
One company would have a selection of these.
Oh, well, nearly every company had every one of those cameras. We had Mitchells, we had Eclairs, we had Newmans, we had at Akeley. Carl Akeley was a cameraman who invented the camera where the film went round the whole of the inside of the camera. I used one in the last war. An Akeley camera is one of the best cameras of its kind you could use.
You mentioned trick filming. Could you say a bit more about that? What do you mean by that?
I can't. I can't think of all the tricks, but I mean, cameramen. I can't remember all what the cameramen did, but there are all sorts of things that cameramen did to get pictures. I don't say the trickery that goes on today in filming Star Wars and things like that. I mean, that is sheer scientific stuff. I mean, that really cleverly worked out. But I'm talking about the trickery that you get. When I said trickery, I was talking about tricks. All the various things you do to get your pictures. For instance, getting the opening of the Mersey Tunnel. We put our cables under the paving stones, had the paving stones dug up, the sand underneath scraped away, laid in the cables, put the paving stones back again, and then the grit over the top of that, so that we could get the King George V speech when he opened the Mersey Tunnel. Nobody else thought of that. That's a bit of trickery, if you like. Same with the opening of the Tyne Bridge. We carried the cable down one side of the bridge, across one of the arches, up to the other side of the bridge, and so that we were able to have the microphone, because the camera was on one side of the bridge and the King was on the other side of the bridge, and we weren't allowed to have wires across the bridge, either over or under it, so we had to go right the way down under the bridge, across the crosspiece, and up the other side of the bridge. We did that, and all sorts of things like this went on. They're all trickeries, all tricks.
What were relations like between your newsreel company and the services? Did they afford you a good facility?
Very well. The services were marvellous, especially the Navy, strange to say. Then nothing was too much trouble. If we ever had permission from the Admiralty to film any naval event, the Navy would really look after you very, very well indeed. Well, the Royal Air Force did, so did the Army, but the Navy were very good. We used to film the... in those days, they used to have what they call the spring cruise in the Mediterranean, which had the Mediterranean fleet exercises in the Mediterranean. So you had ships like HMS Rodney and Hood and various other things, and aircraft carriers, Ark Royal, all doing their stuff. So it made very good pictures.
And you were given every facility?
Every facility. Didn't matter what facility you wanted, you got it. Now, the RAF were limited. The RAF were very, very good. I well remember there were a man in charge of the press office of the Air Ministry was a man named Squadron Leader Robinson, Robbie. He's now dead, but Robinson was possibly one of the finest men I ever knew, and is a very, very great help on any matters relating to the Royal Air Force. I only had to phone up Robbie and say, I want an aeroplane. Can you fly me to so-and-so? Can you do this? Oh, yes, I'll fix it. They'd lay anything on. The Army hadn't got a lot to show in those days, but if there was anything in the Army line, such as demonstrating new tanks or new piece of weaponry, they'd lay it on, they'd give you all the facilities in the world. So I think we had an awful lot of help. It was a question of how you asked for it, I found.
And did the services ever request the newsreel companies to film certain things? Or did the initial invitation always come?
Oh, sometimes, yes, sometimes they would phone up and say, we've got a very interesting thing we're doing, would you like to film it? We'd be very often invited, yes. Oh, yes. I always say do that now. I think they do that now.
Well, they certainly do that now.
Oh, yes, they
the 1930s.
We were... I remember the Admiralty phoning us up one day and saying, would you like to film some depth charge dropping? We've got a new idea of dropping depth charges. Rather spectacular. Would you like to film it? Thank you very much. So we did that.
Would they ring round all the companies?
I couldn't say. I presume they did. I don't think there was any favouritism. I'm sure there was no favouritism anywhere. I mean, it'd be a general press day. We wouldn't be the only ones. They would invite the press as well. For instance, certain days on Salisbury Plain. I remember donkey years ago, before the war, they had a big field day in Salisbury Plain, and they were having dozens and dozens and dozens of tanks there. The army were really putting up a show. They invited everybody, the press, to be there. When I say the press, that meant the newsreels as well. And of course, those things are just showing the opposition what we've got. We invite all the attaches along and all have a look at it.
Did the newsreels consider that military subjects were newsworthy subjects?
Oh, yes. If it was worthwhile. I mean, for instance, you must remember that we were making a newsreel for cinema audiences. And the cinemas in those days was definitely a family affair. I know for a positive fact that most families had what they call their cinema night, and then all the family would go. So our programs were designed to appeal to the family, young and old. And what boy doesn't like looking at aeroplanes flying or doing aerobatics or things like that? Or what boy doesn't mind looking at guns being fired or the Navy doing their job? Of course they make very good pictures. Fleet Review is a marvellous picture. The Royal Review, what used to be the Navy Review.
Did you ever do audience surveys of what the reaction was to your newsreel?
Well, we didn't waste time and money doing that sort of thing. We knew we had an audience. We had a captive audience, cinemas. A very good captive audience in those days. We didn't have to do surveys. You see, we knew, the cinema industry knows, or knew in those days, how many people were going to the cinema. But all the different cinemas got their returns. They know how many people they showed. And you got to get every cinema to send in their figures. Simple matter of arithmetic. An audience business costs a lot of money, and we never worried about that. That's only done now to satisfy the advertisers. You see, advertising is a shocking thing. You're in the middle of a newsreel, and they'll suddenly stop it to show an advert. Advertising some soap powder or something like that. That's not the way to run news, in my opinion. But you see, the world has become very, very commercial now.
You've mentioned your good relations with the services as far as filming is concerned. Did you also find the royal family was very receptive to newsreel?
To a point, yes. Yes. We did some very nice pictures of the various members of the royal family. We had the Queen Mother in Buckingham Palace. Anything about that, she asked us to do it on a Sunday morning. But invited us there, she wanted to talk about something, and I forget what it was now, it didn't matter, it was a lovely picture. She was a lovely lady.
Can you recall George V taking an interest in the cinema?
Not to a very great extent. No, King George V I don't think we knew, we didn't do very much with him, you know. No, the early days, we didn't have an awful lot to do with King George. I'll tell you one little story, an unusual story, the opening of the Empire Swimming Pool by the Duke of Gloucester. We were invited by the Empire Swimming Pool people to film this, and the entire press were there, and all the newsreels. We were allocated a position, and at the precise moment before he opened the swimming pool, I declare the swimming pool well and truly open, as if it wasn't already open. He suddenly said, "Stop all the cameras." So we were flabbergasted. We were invited there. We'd been wined and dined, a very marvellous lunch, handfuls of cigars and everything else. And the Duke of Gloucester, he was a very autocratic type, but he said, "Stop the cameras." So we all just folded up everything and we walked out of the place, went back to the press tent. And that's why there's no pictures of the opening of the Empire Swimming Pool, which was the largest swimming pool in the world at the time, purely because the Duke of Gloucester didn't want the pictures made. So we just the pressmen put their cameras on the ground, and the newsreel people picked their cameras up and went outside, and we went to the mess tent. The press tent. I mean, he was the only man that I can think of that wasn't helpful.
Were you making a lot of noise?
The Prince of Wales was a charming man.